Good morning, this is London. I'll be reading the Decatur Herald and Review, part one for today, Tuesday, June 19th, 2018. We're going to begin on the front page, and our first article is titled New Challenge. This is submitted by Tom Lacey and comes out of Decatur. Gleason chosen as Bloomington's next city manager position. Members of the Decatur City Council will decide next month whether to hire a search firm and who should manage in the interim as they look to replace City Manager Tim Gleason, who is expected to start as Bloomington's next city manager on July 23rd. Bloomington officials announced Monday that Gleason had been chosen for the job over two other finalists, interim Bloomington City Manager Steve Rasmussen and Washington City Administrator Jim Culotta. Bloomington's council will vote on a contract with Gleason on Monday, but members signaled their support during a news conference with Gleason. Decatur Council members plan to discuss their next steps in a closed session following their July 2nd meeting. I'm happy for him, but I hate to see him go, Mayor Julie Moore Wolf said. He has done a great job for us. He really has. He had just great leadership for our community. Gleason said challenges in Bloomington are not dissimilar to those he has faced in Decatur for the past 3 years, and that is part of what appealed to him about the Bloomington job. He will have to prep himself, however, about some of the economic challenges his new city is facing. Bloomington and Normal are premier communities within the state, leaders in many different fronts, and faced with some challenges, Gleason said. I have to understand where we've been in the past, some of the discussions that have occurred, but also respect the fact that this is a new day and we have new opportunities. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner described Gleason as a street-level bureaucrat, noting Gleason's more than 20 years of service with the Pekin Police Department before pursuing a public administration career. Gleason came to Decatur in March of 2015 after a roughly three-month search process, during which the council worked with executive search firm GovHRUSA. Bloomington, in February, hired the same firm. The city manager is expected to begin his new job in Bloomington with a starting salary of $185,000, a $9,000 bump from his Decatur position. The move comes 3 months after the council approved a two-year contract renewal that included a 6% raise and a requirement the city manager give 30 days' notice to leave the position rather than 60. Gleason's salary is $176,507. I was very satisfied in Decatur, but this is one of those opportunities I just had to give it a shot, Gleason said. Gleason came to Decatur from Washington, Illinois, where he had served as city manager for 2.5 years. That included recovery from a devastating tornado in 2013. Renner said the experience showed that Gleason could lead in a crisis. In Decatur, his goals included reshaping how the city managed its finances, tackling major infrastructure needs, and improving its neighborhoods. Faced with a declining population and tax base, he oversaw implementation of new revenue sources approved by the council, including increased utility rates and a new local motor fuel tax to pay for road work. He also scrutinized the cost of city operations, from the refinancing of long-term municipal bonds to consolidating and reorganizing staff departments and cutting the number of city employees. Gleason stressed building up the city's cash reserves, which officials said had dwindled to the point that only 5 days of operating expenses were on hand in December of 2015. If you take a look at everything that was accomplished under his tenure, we made significant progress, City Councilwoman Lisa Gregory said. In his first few months on the job, Gleason raised concerns about a near-completed deal that would have had Macon County offices move into empty space in the Decatur Public Library. The county office building would have been sold to a private developer, Main Place Properties, and the library would have been owned by the Decatur Public Building Commission. Council members balked at the deal after Gleason presented pros and cons of the deal and highlighted outstanding city debt related to the library facility. Instead, the city ultimately took ownership of the facility at 130 North Franklin Street in May of 2016. The situation put Gleason at odds for a time with John Phillips, who was then president of the library board and later ran for mayor in 2017. Gleason's job performance and leadership style became a central issue in the campaign between Phillips and Moore Wolf, who had supported the city manager. Speaking Monday, Phillips said he wished Gleason well and thought Decatur had been a stepping stone for him. He got some stuff done, what he wanted to do, the way he wanted to do it, Phillips said. In my view, it would be nicer to have someone who could be there 10 years and create longer-term growth. Phillips was also among those who criticized Gleason's firing of former Decatur Police Chief Brad Sweeney in February of 2016. Sweeney filed a wrongful termination lawsuit, alleging that he was fired in part as retaliation for his objection to Gleason's use of a public police vehicle to travel to St. Louis for personal business immediately following a city event in May of 2015. Gleason denied that Sweeney objected and said the trip was authorized by the late Mayor Mike McElroy. Gleason and the city said in court documents that he had made the decision based on Sweeney's job performance. The case was dismissed by judges at the trial and appellate court levels. Sweeney and the city reached a separation agreement in May that changed his status from terminated to retired. Even as the city faced major financial challenges this year, Gleason encouraged the council to keep a steady course toward its major goals. The council in December approved a budget with a $3.2 million deficit, about $1.5 million of which stemmed from lost state funding. Gleason said the spending plan would allow city staff to carry on important work that included planning for the Brush College Road Overpass Project, a sweeping neighborhood revitalization initiative, and bond payments for sewer infrastructure updates ordered by the federal EPA. Some financial relief has come in recent years from the private foundation of Macon County Sheriff Howard G. Buffett. The philanthropist and son of multi-billionaire Warren Buffett has poured money into the city's police department and offset city expenses in other ways by funding the installation of a fiber optic network and the creation of a regional emergency dispatch center. More recently, the Buffett Foundation donated $1 million to the long-awaited Neighborhood Revitalization Project, which Gleason and the council launched in September. City leaders spent months seeking residents' feedback to prioritize concerns and shape solutions. While the wide-ranging plan covers everything from economic development to quality of life, one of the first steps is likely the raising of dilapidated properties, more than 100 in all, that have lingered on the city's demolition list for years. The council on Monday also voted to authorize Gleason to negotiate to buy abandoned residential lots held by the Macon County trustee. Moore Wolf said city leaders would continue to pursue the revitalization efforts and other major projects. This has not been a one-man show, she said. He has a very strong staff, so we are going to proceed as planned and move ahead. City Councilwoman Dana Ray said Gleason had done a good job training his staff and not micromanaging, so the city is well positioned to maintain its momentum. I wish him the best, she said. He was a good city manager in that he was able to fulfill the goals that the city council set before him, and he will be greatly missed. That concludes that article, and you can contact Tom Lisi at area code 217-421-6949. Continuing on the front page, our next article is titled Rezoning Approved for Latest Northside Development. This is submitted by Ryan Voiles and comes out of Decatur. New commercial development could soon fill the northwest corner of Mound Road and U.S. Business 51 after the Decatur City Council agreed on Monday to rezone the three-acre site. The project, which includes two buildings totaling nearly 18,000 square feet, would be the latest addition to an area on the city's north side that has recently attracted increased attention from developers looking to bring business to Decatur. It is across the street from Mound Center, which includes Target, Olive Garden, and Starbucks, and could soon feature a new tenant in the building with Ashley Furniture. Just down the street, the city of Decatur plans to invest $2 million in a fire station near Greenridge Drive. About half a mile north, a development anchored by Chipotle Mexican Grill is planned at West Ash Avenue and U.S. Business 51. From a developer standpoint, I guess they still see a need for retail, commercial, office-type usage in that area, said Raymond Lay, the city's community economic development director. It is a high-traffic area with a large customer base nearby. Those may be just some of the reasons. Location was key for one potential tenant of the development approved Monday, said Mary Cave, an engineer with Chastain and Associates, who is representing the project. She described the tenant of the 13,000 square foot building as a medical office, but said its representatives did not yet want to be identified. They need a location in northern Decatur or Forsyth. They're looking in Decatur, she said. They do not want central, they do not want southern, they want northern Decatur, and this is available. After half an hour of discussion, the council voted 6-1 to approve the rezoning. Councilman Bill Faber voted against the measure, saying the development on West Mound would not be good for the community. The last thing this community needs is another medical building, he said. The second, smaller building is not explicitly billed as a restaurant, but the plans call for a drive-through as part of its total 4,800-square-foot layout. No specific restaurants or retail businesses have been identified, Cave said. We are hoping to have that all developed soon, she said. The council also approved an amendment to prohibit the use of video gaming terminals. Other prohibited uses include tattoo or piercing parlors, video gambling parlors, and gas stations. The possibility of a new restaurant down the street was exciting for Justin Hayes, 22, and Lena Rochamal, 21, who live in the Prairie Hills Apartments on Mound Road. It is always cool to see new businesses pop up, Rochamal said. It will be a nice addition to the neighborhood. Not everyone agrees. Zach Jones, 30, lives north of the development site on Newcastle Drive. We'll see, he said, referring to the new development. Restaurants do not stay here very long. It will probably end up being just another empty building. He also is not looking forward to constant sirens with construction of the new fire station, plans for which the council approved in January. It will replace Station 5 on East Christine Drive, currently the northernmost of the city's seven fire stations. The traffic is going to be terrible there, Jones said. All the people at Target come through, and on top of that, it is residential. Still, the rezoning on West Mound did not draw nearly as many concerned neighbors as in January, when the council voted to rezone 1.6 acres at the southwest corner of U.S. Business 51 and West Ash Avenue for the development, including Chipotle. Residents had strongly objected to the move, citing worries about heavy traffic and the potential that their property values would decline. That development is overseen by Northbrook-based GMX Real Estate Group. Representatives previously said they hoped to finish work by the end of this year, but as of Monday afternoon, no construction has begun at the site. Lay said Monday that he believed plans were moving ahead for the development and that GMX was looking to finalize tenants for the space. GMX co-manager Andrew Goodman did not return a message left Monday afternoon on his cell phone. He has not returned multiple messages seeking updates left at his office or cell phone since January. Another area set to open soon for potential business is the space next to Ashley Furniture in Mound Center. About 6,800 square feet adjoining the furniture store was designed for retail and restaurant use. When the store opened in 2016, owner John Harrison said he hoped to fill the space as soon as possible. But in a phone interview on Monday, Harrison said he ended up expanding the furniture store and using that vacant space to keep clearance items and other inventory overflow. A new distribution center to store that furniture is set to open in the next 90 days, he said, meaning the spot in Mound Center will be open for potential tenants again. From day one, we've had a long list of companies that want to go in there, Harrison said. The only hurdle, he said, could come in the form of a previous agreement between the city of Decatur and the nearby Target. Harrison said it prevents service businesses such as a hair salon from setting up shop in the building and limits the space that could be made available for a restaurant. Chipotle wanted to come in here at one point, but we can only allow 1,100 square feet for restaurant usage, Harrison said. In posts on social media and comments at past city council meetings, some residents have questioned why developers continue to target the north side of Decatur for new construction, rather than occupying vacant buildings in other parts of the city. Speaking in general, Lay said there are a number of factors driving the trend: nearby businesses, availability of land, high traffic counts, and overall cost. The only time the City Decatur Council weighs in when projects require rezoning, Lay said, such as changing an area designated for residential use to one that allows commercial projects. If the property is available, then it comes to whether the owner is willing to sell and for how much, Lay said. It is something the developer will have to keep in consideration because they will want to control that site. That concludes the article, and you can contact Ryan Voiles at area code 217-421-7985. The next article on the front page is Council OK's Garbage Fee Increase, submitted by Tom Lacey out of Decatur. Residents share stories of poor service. As they approved a $3 monthly rate increase for residents' garbage collection service, Decatur City Council members said they wanted to simplify the way complaints about garbage service are handled by the city. Documents obtained by the Herald and Review last week through a Freedom of Information Act request show that city staff have dealt with just 16 garbage-related complaints since January of 2016. But posts on social media in response to the garbage fee increase painted a different picture, and two residents who spoke at the meeting on Monday spent a combined 25 minutes detailing years of issues with their hauler. Councilwoman Lisa Gregory said the remedy was good old-fashioned customer service. This is not difficult, and we should not make it any more difficult than it has to be, she said. I think a lot of that, too, is really the tone and the attitude in which we address our citizens. The discussion came as the council unanimously approved the fee increase effective July 1st. The measure increases basic residential fee for residences' garbage removal from $14.50 a month to $17.50. Expanded residential service, which allows residents to put out 2 96-gallon garbage totes instead of one, would increase from $17.50 to $20.50. Each would increase 50 cents every July until 2021. Both the $1 extra per month for unlimited yard waste and $2.15 per month recycling charges would stay unchanged. City Manager Tim Gleason cited growing concern from Decatur's haulers of rising business costs in the 8 years since the last fee increase. That was also the year the council approved reducing pickups from 2 days to one and altered how recycling was handled, among other changes. The increases were approved as the council prepares to renew the municipal contract with private garbage haulers, including Advanced Disposal, the largest of the providers. The publicly traded company based in Florida operates in 16 states and the Bahamas. Nancy and Gary Funk, who live in the Millican Heights neighborhood on Decatur's west side, spoke passionately about their problems with Advanced Disposal, with Nancy Funk saying that there had to be a remedy for the company to stop making excuses for poor service. In response, Decatur attorney Ed Flynn, who represents Advanced Disposal and several other garbage haulers, said the company's success rate is astronomical when comparing the number of complaints compared to the more than 3 million residential garbage pickups made in the city every year. When asked about how Advanced could improve its response to customers like the Funks, I don't know how much simpler you can make that process. Fill out a simple form, it is processed, and it proceeds forward. But I would be open to suggestions, Flynn said. Council members directed city staff to ensure that the complaints are being heard. I think we should have one point person where the complaints are going, instead of having several different routes, Councilwoman Dana Ray said. Unfortunately, it does not always get to the right person. Speaking after the meeting, Deputy City Manager Billy Tyus said there is a staff member designated to handle those complaints, but the city needed to work toward making sure the appropriate phone number is publicized. That phone number is area code 217-450-2347. That concludes that article, and you can contact Tom Alisi at area code 217-421-6949. The last article on the front page is titled Unpleasant Surprise. This is about the Logan Palmer case, is submitted by Tony Reed, and comes out of Decatur. Families of killed sailors sued by shipping company. The owners of a ship that collided with the USS McCain, killing 10 aboard, including a Decatur area native, are asking a court to free it from liability claims or strictly limit how much the Navy and the families of sailors who died or were injured can sue for compensation. The legal petition by the company that owns the commercial oil tanker Alnick, which struck the McCain in August near Singapore, was filed in New York federal court. The litigation seeks exoneration from liability or moves to cap the pool of money available to pay compensation to just $16.7 million. For Teresa Palmer, the mother of Harristown sailor Logan Palmer, 23, who died in the McCain collision, the legal action came as an insulting, unpleasant surprise. When the families first got news of it, we were very upset, very angry, said Palmer, 55. We are already bereaved, and now here is just one more thing to add to it all. Palmer acknowledges that the Navy has admitted it made serious mistakes in the way her son's ship was being run, but she also is insistent in saying she believes the Alnwick was handled recklessly at best, and its crew's incompetence was a significant factor in the collision that killed her son. And she said the real tragedy in all of this is that whatever judges eventually may decide to award the families won't be enough. There is not enough money to bring back any of our sons, she said. U.S. Representative Rodney Davis, Republican from Taylorville, said news of the shipping company's legal action was tragic. Davis was in Decatur for a roundtable meeting with military families that included U.S. Representative Mac Thornberry, chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. Davis said he had briefed Thornberry on the development after speaking with Logan Palmer's father, Sid Palmer. This is going to be a topic of discussion in our roundtable, Davis added. I think it is tragic that any company, no matter where they're based, is filing a lawsuit against the families who lost their children. Davis pledged to do everything he could to make sure this distraction for the Palmers and other bereaved families is done away with as quickly as possible. But now the titanic legal battle commences. A statement from Arnold and Itkin, a Houston law firm representing 9 of the families, including the Palmers, said the Energetic Tank Incorporated, which owned the Alnwick, is trying to take advantage of the Limited Liability Act of 1851 maritime law created to help the early merchant fleet of the United States by limiting the liability of ship owners to the value of the vessel should disaster befall the ship. The statement said Energetic claims that the vessel was worth $16.7 million and that the combined amount of compensation for any claims filed by the Navy, injured sailors, or the families of sailors can be no more than $16.7 million. The Alnwick legal action would force all claimants, if the shipping company is found liable, to accept this pool of cash as the only source available for compensation. Corey Itkin, a partner with Arnold and Itkin, described the Limited Liability Act as being used as a legal shield to stave off future claims for realistic recompense. Now it is just an obsolete law that lets shipping companies wash their hands and walk away from deadly disasters, he said. Palmer, an interior communications electrician on the guided missile destroyer, and the other 9 sailors who died were in their sleeping quarters at the time of the collision on August 21st, according to a report the Navy released on November 1st. In a court filing answering the Energetic Tank lawsuit and rejecting any attempt to limit possible compensation amounts, attorneys for Teresa Palmer, who represents her son's estate, said his mother had suffered a tremendous loss with the death of her son. They insist the Alnwick's crew and owners are liable for that loss. The motor vessel Alnwick's crew, owners, and operators violated their basic duties and then filed the lawsuit against the Navy sailors and their families, Teresa Palmer's lawsuit said. I'm going to need to stop here and continue this article, which is very important, in part 2 section. So I'm going to take a short break and hope that you will return to listen to us complete this article and the further reading of part 2 of the Decatur Herald and Review for today, Tuesday, June 19th, 2018.